If you read headline articles about food and nutrition, you may sometimes be confused about what to eat or what supplements you should take. Today, we're going to break down several popular nutrition trends. This is The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information from the world's leading experts on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, connect, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician scientist and lifestyles medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Tim Radak. Dr. Radak is academic coordinator for a public health PhD program at Walden University, where he has taught public health courses since 2010. He previously served as assistant professor of nutrition and dietetic internship director at Appalachian State University, senior research program manager for the Cancer Prevention Institute of California, and director of nutrition for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He has been credentialed as a registered dietitian since 2000 and earned his doctorate in public health nutrition at Loma Linda University. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon. It's a pleasure to be here and really looking forward to the conversation today.
Tim, tell us about what your current role is. What do you do at Walden University?
So I serve as the academic program coordinator for our public health program. And the student population is from really around the world. It's an online program. So we get students from literally many, many different countries. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to work with students, mentoring students, as well as helping them with their courses. And I really like the academic world, but the other hat that I wear also is as a researcher. And my main focus is really looking at chronic disease risk reduction and the association with diets, particularly plant-based diets, what evidence we have in the research world for that.
What got you interested in your areas of research?
Well, it really goes back to my grandmother. My grandmother, in her early 70s, was diagnosed with cardiovascular disease, needed to get a triple bypass surgery. And she eventually succumbed to that disease just a few years later. And I started asking questions about that, asking, did that have to happen? Did it have to happen at that time? And was there anything that she could have done differently in her lifestyle that could have changed that prognosis? And life or years of life lost is incredibly precious, as we all know. And if there's anything that we can do within our power to modify that and have more positive outcome, then that's a worthwhile endeavor. So that's really what got me started. And immediately what grabbed my attention was nutrition. And so that's where I started researching different diets and foods and starting to understand that I think I need to go back to school into the nutrition world. So I pursued several master's and doctoral degrees as well as a registered dietitian credential to help support my path in that journey.
And thanks to the research that you and other people do, we know so much more today than when your grandmother was our age. It's really amazing how much more we know about what's in our power and control. And the flip side is what we're talking about today, which is there's almost too much information to the point where it can also get confusing.
Absolutely right. And I think in the last three decades in particular, the amount of research has grown to such a sizable amount that we now can make recommendations with solid evidence and a solid backing to support those recommendations. And that's really important because, like you said, quite a while ago, we just didn't have enough to support making recommendations. We used things like, you know, vegetables are healthy for us, but we really didn't know why they were healthy and what quantity to consume them in and how to prepare them. They were sort of old wives' tales, if you will, but they actually rang true. The evidence supports the intake of fruits and vegetables for a healthy lifestyle.
So with the theme of heart disease, I know one of the questions I get asked a lot is around omega-3 supplements, like whether a person should take them or not. Tell us a little bit about the history of omega-3s and kind of bring us to the current time to kind of help people navigate that decision.
Sure. Well, I mean, navigating the food and nutrition world is incredibly complex because there's so much research out there. And also with the introduction of the World Wide Web, there's even more information that's available to health professionals and consumers. And as we probably will all agree, a lot of what's on the internet is not necessarily valid and can introduce all types of bias. So navigating that world can be really, really complex. And we're also bombarded with health information from non-health sources out in the media, as well as other special interests that are trying to promote certain foods. And so it can be really, really difficult because marketing is really the main driver of nutrition information. And that information often comes with a bias. And so with that in mind, essential fatty acids are really, really important because in particular fish oil supplements, they're really the number one most purchased and consumed supplement after a vitamin and mineral supplement. So there's a tremendous amount of interest in fish oil supplements. And so when we go back and talk a little bit about essential fatty acids in particular, we mainly focus on omega-3 fatty acids and omega-6 fatty acids. There are also omega-7 and 9 fatty acids, but those can be synthesized from other fats. And so what makes omega-3 and omega-6 unique is that we need to have an outside or exogenous source for our well-being. And so the requirements of these are not very large. They're really only needed in small amounts. And so if we go back to the kind of the original research that really started launching into this was back in 1979. I mean, researcher Deng and Dieberg were looking at Greenland Inuit Eskimos. And some of those Eskimos migrated over to Denmark. And so what happened is when that migration took place, the incidence of cardiovascular disease increased significantly. And that led the researchers to believe that the Greenland Eskimo diet had something in it that was conferring health benefits from a cardiovascular disease standpoint. And so what they believed was the main component was the long chain fatty acids that are omega-3 fatty acids that we call EPA DHA, eicosapentaenoic acid, and docosahexaenoic acid. And so these particular fatty acids were really responsible for igniting a frenzy of research into omega-3 fatty acids that span for decades and continues even to this very day. I think just about every disease or disorder has been researched from the standpoint of whether omega-3 fatty acids play a role. And the most significant one, obviously, is cardiovascular disease, because that's where the original research started. So the interesting thing about that research that was back in 1979 is that they looked at just a small population of Greenland Eskimos, just about 7 people really in a small village, and they relied on annual reports from death certificates and hospital admissions from all of Greenland. And they believe that from that data, coronary heart disease was only at about 5% of the population. And we could compare that to back in those days, the U.S. rate was about 40%. So we were talking about a possible significant reduction in coronary heart disease. The problem with that research is that only a fraction of the death certificates really involved a physician examining the patient or the body. If you think about Greenland, it's very rural. There's lots of villages and they're very, very remote areas. And they don't necessarily have all the diagnostic techniques and materials to be able to assess what the actual death was. And so that's really important, because if we don't identify what the disease incidence was correctly, then we could be basically creating data that is not valid. And that's really exactly what happened, because we now know that Greenland Eskimos have significant amount of atherosclerosis. Much more actually than in the Denmark population, as well as the United States. And there was even some research last year that looked at mummies that were 500 years old in Greenland, and they also showed clear evidence of atherosclerosis. So the life expectancy of Greenland Eskimos is also about 10 years shorter than the Danish population. So it effectively dismisses the cardioprotective effect from Eskimo diets, of which this was primarily seafood. And I wanted to give you a quote from Dr. Joanne Manson, the professor of medicine at Harvard University, who says, "It's amazing how popular fish oil supplements have become without conclusive evidence of their efficacy." So I thought this is just a really good topic to cover, because even though there's some good media reports out there that are explaining that fish oil supplements do not have a cardioprotective effect, that has not reduced the amount of consumption and purchases of fish oil supplements to the point where some research has suggested that fish stocks in the ocean are declining to the point of extinction because of the fish oil supplement being produced. So that's kind of what started this journey, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So interesting looking at the history behind it. And mechanistically, can you also tie together the role that an omega-3 fatty acid, is this essential fatty acid, may have with heart disease in terms of inflammation and anti-inflammation?
Mm-hmm, sure. So fish oil or omega-3 fatty acid from fish oil or other plant-based sources do have a hallmark effect of reducing triglycerides, but the other variables or risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease, such as LDL cholesterol, or endpoints like atrial fibrillation or cardiovascular disease mortality, have not panned out. And there's several, at least 3 to 5 meta-analyses that have come out that have reviewed dozens and dozens of studies to illustrate this. So even though there's a reduction in triglycerides, and fish oil in terms of essential fatty acids, omega-3, have an anti-inflammatory effect, we have to weigh that against whether the body really wants extra amounts of omega-3 fatty acids to perform those anti-inflammation effects. And the FDA even mentioned that fish oil supplements could carry a risk in terms of increased bleeding times. And even the U.S. military has been doing research with bleeding times, because when you're out on the field in military combat, the last thing you want is to have prolonged bleeding times if there's an injury. So there are some risks from that standpoint as well. And there's even a few studies that actually show a negative relationship from consuming fish oil supplements in terms of atrial fibrillation. So some of these trials have actually showed a negative effect as well. So to put all that together, there isn't enough significant research to demonstrate a protective effect, either from a primary or secondary prevention from taking fish oil supplements.
Yeah, and primary prevention, can you explain the difference between primary and secondary prevention?
Sure. So with primary prevention, we're really talking about stopping or mitigating a disease before it starts. So for example, engage in lifestyle behaviors to promote a healthy lifestyle that reduce your risk of certain diseases. And when we have secondary prevention, that's more about for folks that have established diseases and how to reduce that disease once it's actually diagnosed. So that's the distinction between primary and secondary prevention.
So let's take the scenario. If I'm a person who may have, for example, a family history of heart disease, and I want to do everything I can to reduce my personal risk, what would you recommend for me in terms of omega-3 fatty acids?
So in terms of omega-3 fatty acids, as I mentioned, the body does require a certain amount, and the amount is so small that the federal government was unable to establish an RDA, which is a recommended daily allowance, because there just isn't enough evidence to support a need. And the same goes with the long-chain fatty acids as well, EPA and DHA. But they do have what's called adequate intakes, and so they have recommendations for adequate intakes. And studies that looked at the population suggested that we're meeting those recommendations almost twice as much as what the adequate intake would be. So if I had to make any recommendations in terms of essential fatty acids, with particular focus on omega-3s, there are a number of foods that contain these that aren't necessarily seafood or fish. And fortunately, nature has distributed omega-3 fatty acids very far and wide. You can even take the seeds of a red raspberry, for example, that contains omega-3 fatty acids. Certain greens do as well. Certain legumes and beans do. And what's very common in terms of omega-3 fatty acids is flax seed or flax meal or chia seed or walnuts. And these are all very high sources of omega-3 fatty acids. And there's certainly no reason not to consume a few of those, but also not to overdo it, because there's kind of a competition in the body for omega-3 fatty acids and omega-6 fatty acids. And so if you have too much of one, that can reduce the metabolism of the other. So a good thing is great, but too much of a good thing could actually be counterproductive.
So most people in this country are getting adequate omega-3 fatty acids just from their diet.
Generally. And, you know, the caveat there is that they're following a well-planned diet. The standard American diet is rife with negative factors in terms of high saturated fat or low fiber intake, or you have risk factors like high blood pressure, which is prevalent. So the diet does we do need to give some consideration to diet. And since we have really in this population a very animal-centric, animal protein intake diet, the problem with that is that fat contains what is known as arachidonic acid, and that's a omega-6 fatty acid, and that competes with omega-3. And so while omega-3s have an anti-inflammatory profile, the arachidonic acid omega-6 has a pro-inflammatory profile. So if you're consuming a lot of animal products, you're likely to have a considerable increase in arachidonic acid. So it may not be an issue so much as what your intake of omega-3 is, but what your intake of omega-6 is. And those who follow plant-based diets won't have that problem, because not consuming animal products means they're not going to produce arachidonic acid from what they consume.
So the keys, of course, are the ratio, if you will, of the omega-6 to omega-3. I want to go through a couple different scenarios. If someone is plant-based, you'd mentioned flaxseed as a good source and other plant-based sources. The plant-based sources have more ALA, and the conversion to the DHA and EPA is extremely slow. On a plant-based diet, using the dietary sources that you mentioned, is there adequate conversion, or should people who are 100% plant-based or on vegetarian or vegan diets, is there a role for supplementation there?
That's a great question. It's a question that I get all the time as a registered dietitian. And so the way I would kind of frame this is that even though the conversion rate from ALA, which is alpha-linolenic acid, omega-3, down to EPA and DHA is limited, I think it's limited for a very good reason, because these long-chain fatty acids, EPA and DHA, create very, very potent and powerful molecules, and they're very short-lived. And so I don't think the body actually wants to have a lot of those around. And the other side of the equation is also with omega-6. What isn't really talked about much is that the conversion rate for omega-6 fatty acids that start with linolenic acid and go all the way down to arachidonic acid, that conversion process is also very slow. And that's one of the reasons why those who consume plant-based diets and consume linolenic omega-3 or omega-6 fatty acids don't really have much arachidonic acid status levels. But when you consume animal products, you get an immediately preformed source of arachidonic acid. So for those following plant-based diets, as you mentioned, the ratio is important, because there is competition between omega-3 and omega-6. But the body has really fine-tuned that conversion process, and I think it's intentionally limited. And it's also interesting that when you look at women who are pregnant, for example, the body's conversion of alpha-linolenic acid to EPA and DHA markedly increases. And then after that pregnancy is concluded, we'll go back down to regular levels. So the body will adapt to what needs are for incorporating omega-3 fatty acids, but there are also some risk factors that could reduce that incorporation. For example, smoking and trans fats and saturated fats all can reduce that conversion rate, which is why your overall diet is important to consider when you're thinking about omega-3 fatty acids. And there's a very small amount of the population that has an enzyme deficiency along these pathways for both omega-3 and omega-6. It's called the FAD2 enzyme. And if you happen to be carrier of that particular enzyme, then it probably is a good idea to increase your omega-3 fatty acid intake to accommodate that. But there's also the question of what would a follower of a plant-based diet consume as a supplement if they can't have fish oil supplements? And to answer that, we have to kind of understand, well, where do fish get their omega-3 fatty acids? And they simply get it from plankton and algae. So about 10 years ago, we were able to see out in the nutrition market, you could now have algae capsules that you can consume, which is a pure source of EPA and DHA. But again, since the evidence doesn't support fish oil supplements, it really doesn't support taking an algae supplement either. And there's several studies actually that show when you're consuming oil supplements, which are really a refined oil, a refined product, there can be some other deleterious factors like an increase in LDL cholesterol. So it's not as simple as just taking a supplement and feeling that we can be confident that we're covered.
Let's take the other scenario. If someone has a very Western diet, lots of animal protein, as you mentioned, their omega-6 intake is high. Do they need to take more omega-3s to balance that ratio?
They certainly could, but I think the best initial approach would be simply to reduce your omega-6 intake. And that's also a fantastic question because most of us don't really know where omega-6 fatty acids occur in the food system. And the primary source is strict oil, vegetable oils like canola oil, for example, and the many, many, many processed foods that are in convenience foods that are available at the grocery store are also a rich source of omega-3 fatty acids. So we probably all can agree that consuming processed foods is probably not in our best interest for health. But there's another reason as well, because you can increase your omega-6 fatty acids, which could offset the incorporation of omega-3 fatty acids. So a little complex, but just to summarize, being aware of where your omega-6 fatty acids come from, again, from processed foods and vegetable oils, and making sure we moderate our intake of those will ensure that we have kind of a reasonable ratio between the two fatty acids.
And there's so many other trends I want to unpack, and we may have to have you come back for a subsequent episode for us to really dig into some other trends. In terms of the omega-3s, with the time we have left, can you also just speak very briefly as to secondary prevention? As you mentioned, how about for people who have known heart disease? Is there a role for omega-3 supplements there?
The only possible role is with the reduction of triglycerides. And triglycerides can also be reduced by following an adequately planned plant-based diet. So there's other ways to reduce triglycerides if that's a concern. But for the other indices like mortality and other cardiovascular mortality disease outcomes, there just isn't enough evidence to support that there's a benefit for secondary prevention. And there are many, many, many studies out there compiled in a meta-analysis that suggest that. But that has not actually stopped other organizations from still promoting fish oil supplements. Even the American Heart Association still recommends to consume seafood and for cardiovascular disease risk reduction. And I think one of the reasons why is because if you compare fish to other animal meats like red meat and poultry, it does have a better profile in terms of cardiovascular disease risk. And we saw this happen in the 1980s when federal recommendations were advising us to cut down on our red meat, to cut down on saturated fat. And so what happened is consumers just started switching from red meat to other forms of meat or to increasing seafood because at the same time, fish oil supplements were becoming very popular. And so if you compare those two side by side, it would suggest that there's a benefit to fish or fish oil supplement. But what's outside of this equation is other diets. And so if you take a look at plant-based diets and you compare those to fish, the outcomes are very clear that plant-based diets have a much more favorable health outcome.
This is really just great information, Tim. First of all, thank you for all the work you do. There are so many other trends that I want to dig into. And like I said, we'll save them for maybe a subsequent time. But thank you for the work that you do. And it's just been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, likewise, it's always great to be able to talk about things that really are important and then also carry either health benefits or health risks and helping individuals navigate the complex nutritional world that we find ourselves in is really a joy. It's my life's passion. And it's wonderful that we have enough research now that we can stand behind making recommendations to help people feel confident in their health decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. I really love hearing feedback, so please leave a review to let me know what you think and rate this podcast. The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness and is copyrighted by Emory University. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.